Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 157 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I prefer to be called the Enormous Ophidian. I'm Mark.
For what?
You're an enormous something, Mark.
Big snake, big grand serpent.
Yeah.
Right, so what's been going on since last we met? I know Mark's got a parcel to open, so let's just get rid of a few things. Have you heard about this missing but not really missing episode that's been found?
Yeah, explain more, Doc, because I was a bit confused by this.
As far as I can tell, reading a post online by none other than Paul Venizes, 40T, when they were creating the beginning box set, which I think is the first three stories of Doctor Who, from 1963. Obviously, they transferred all the negatives from BBC archives to create the DVDs, and they found that the can for the negative of episode 7 of the Daleks turned out not to have a picture negative, just a sound negative. And so they had to use a surviving print, which was a bit scratched and dodgy. And then during a, I think, fairly routine search of the William Hartnell episode negatives that the BFI holds, they thought that their only copy of episode 7 was, again, a sound negative. When they physically checked it, it turned out to be, I think, the original picture negative.
Oh,
right, got it.
So somebody put them back in the wrong cans.
So it sounds like it, yeah. So BBC's can saying picture negative had the sound negative. BFI's can saying sound negative had the picture negative.
We are all together, Gugukichu.
Do you know what? That is insane. Because recently as well, I know Mark Ayres was discussing at a BFI event that they found a load of really high quality audio copies of black and white Doctor Who, basically. So, you know, the domestic recordings off the telly. Yeah. Really, really high quality recordings at a landfill site, wasn't it? Or at a tip?
Ooh.
Somewhere in the country?
Oh, yes.
This was in the last year or two. And this is one of the reasons why the animations are starting to come out at a fair old pace now, because they've got better audio for them now. But they were found at a tip. I can't remember if it was a landfill or a tip. It might have been a tip. I think someone alerted them to the fact that these things were there, and they were clearly marked Doctor Who. And yeah, it's extraordinary just how, well, we're getting on for 60 years now, aren't we? And these things are still turning up.
Mm.
Gives a bit of hope that missing episodes might turn up, like you said.
Forever hopeful.
So that sounds promising for... They've not done the collection box set for season one yet, have they? No, I don't think they have they?
No.
Did you also see this thing that I read somewhere fairly obscure that, you know, this idea they've got that when Russell T. Davis and Bad Wolf take over in 2023, I don't think anyone's actually said it's going to happen, but there's been rumours, haven't they? Oh, they might try doing like a Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, where they're doing umpteen different spin-offs and that. Someone noticed that in November, Bad Wolf has registered a company name called Hooniverse One Limited, which makes you wonder. So it may mean nothing. Did you notice on that episode 5 of The Flux in the UK when it was broadcast on the Sunday night, the BBC continuity announcer said, and now for all of you in the Hooniverse.
Yeah.
Which sounded quite condescending. But as the end credits were running after next week, what happens next week, they did a continuity announcement over the end credits, was if you want to binge watch Class, and I'm sure that all of you in the fandom do, then you can find it on BBC iPlayer. You thought, the fandom, oh dear. I mean, fandom would be bad enough, but the fandom is almost going out of your way to sound clunky, isn't it?
Dear, oh dear.
Anything else been happening with you chaps? Before we look at Mark's parcel?
Mark's package.
Before we look at Mark's package? Now, Mark, you've won something recently, haven't you?
Yeah. You know, on Twitter, they have people will try to promote their businesses and stuff, or books and things, and they'll give away on Twitter, which will usually involve you having to follow whoever's running the competition and retweet the tweet and stuff. And then they put everyone's name who's done that into a program, and they pick someone at random. Well, obviously, I've been doing that sort of thing for years. Not to promote my own stuff, but entering these competitions. And once I won somebody got a plastic printer and they'd made a small Emperor Dalek. And I won that, but it never got sent. And the person never responded to my questions as to where it was. And in fact, they never really appeared on Twitter again. So I don't know what happened to that person.
I hope you unfollowed him.
I can't remember now. It was about 3 years ago. There's a company called, I might as well plug them. The Unreality Store, who are at Unreality Store on Twitter, and in Wellingborough, it's a comic book shop, and they had a competition to win a stack of 49 issues or progs of 2000 AD from around 1982, which was probably the time I started buying it. So it will be fairly classic stuff. And I've just received the box today. It's just arrived. So. It doesn't look as big as I'd expect a box of nearly 50 comics to look. But it's, I suppose it's fairly big.
Dog?
Yeah?
Imagine if there's the other half of his Galen in there as well.
Oh no!
Oh yeah!
Oh my god!
Well, that should be everything but his foot then.
Exactly. Footless Galen.
It's all packaged very nicely.
This is sort of a Secret Santa 1 week in advance, 1 month podcast in advance, isn't it?
There's some other stuff tucked in. What is this?
Jammy.
Right, okay. So I've got a big stack of comics, 2000 ADs, from prog 243, by the look of it, through to. 2000 AD, Prog 300, with the free badge, free Judge Dredd badge on the front.
No! Jammy!
Who was it saying that he's never jammy? I mean, you do realise this is going to be Mark's jamminess running out.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah.
Normal service will be resumed.
Hell from here on. Yeah.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Oh, that's interesting, because when they when they brought out the Judge Dredd, almost like omnibus hardbacks of various stories they had, if you subscribed to them, which I did for a while before losing interest, you could get certain free prizes. And one was a little tin full of Judge Dredd coffee mug coasters. And one was one of those. I mean, it must have been a copy of it. God, 300. You started reading in 1982, did you, Mark? I don't mean reading full stop.
I think, yeah, around then. It was around the 300s. Absolute classic stuff in here, just going through the covers.
Oh, I do remember that. That's what I remember more. On the face of that 300, they reprinted in a sort of mini pullout the original Prog 1. I do remember putting that together.
I've also been given number 2 of a 90s... comic strip compilation comic called Strip. Issue 0 of something called Controversy, which I've never heard of. Atlas and Axis, another comic book. WWE Heroes number 1.
Wow.
Yeah.
Monsters vs. Aliens, the M Files. graphic novel, and the first edition of Crisis, which was an offshoot from 2000 AD, had two stories in it. Third World War by Pat Mills and Carlos Esquerra, and New Statesman, which was kind of like an adult superhero thing, came out around the same time as The Watchmen. But yeah, number one of that. That's great. That's loads of stuff to read over the next few nights. Oh, I'm marvellous.
We could do that to con people into following the podcast on Twitter, because I've got the first 10 years of 2000 AD in boxes in my mum's garage.
Oh, I'll be entering it though to win them. It'll just be me retweeting.
Well, if anyone's interested, I have quite an extensive collection of Beano comics from about 1990 onwards.
Oh, a bit late for me. I think I got an issue, I can't remember whether it was 500 or 1,000 now. It must be 1,000, because when I was a kid. Excellent.
1982.
Wow.
I started with Prog 1 in February or January 1977.
Well, that sounds about right, because I would be approximately that many years behind you, wouldn't I?
Yeah, which my dad threw out before I could save it. My dad used to go through some fits of tidying up, and he'd shove all the newspapers on top of the fridge until the day before the bins were collected, he'd take them all out. He must have just...
It's amazing, isn't it? I had a huge collection of Star Wars figures and a little bit of a collection of stuff from, like, you know, tie-in movies from, like, Batman in the 90s and Jurassic Park and all this kind of thing. And for years, it was the collection of toys that seemed lost forever in my parents' loft. And last year, just before the second lockdown, I actually tied it out. I completely cleared out my mum's loft late summer's day. Spent the whole day clearing it out. And you know what, lads? I never found them. Which means that my dad, instead of putting them up in the loft, I reckon gave them either to a charity shop or sold them.
The meanie.
And I wish he was here right now, because I got taller than him after the age of 15. So we have a right old sort out, I'll tell you that.
I'm just searching through the very early incarnations of Twitter. Here we are. 1992. At Alan Gribble. Follow me and I'll let you have some... Follow me and I'll let you have some of my son's collection of comics. The meanie.
I'll tell you what, that is just... Oh.
My stepdad took all my Star Wars toys to the dump after I moved out.
Oh, no.
Unbelievable.
Because the stuff is so priceless now. Like, I've recently been in the build-up to Christmas. I've discovered a load of, what would you call them? Sort of compilations of vintage Christmas adverts. And there's an Asda advert, I'll share it in the show notes, where they're advertising the original Millennium Falcon. And it was something like 1999 or something. Just under 20 quid.
Yeah, that's still quite expensive though for the time. But, you know, worth it.
I'll tell you what, if you had it now.
Well, yeah, exactly. Good investment. I did have an X-Wing fighter, which was taken to the dump. So, yeah.
I once saw, round about in the run-up to Christmas in Morrison's, which is a chain of supermarkets in the north, listeners, the big model for the TIE fighter. I did think at the age of about 25, I was a bit too old for that, so I didn't buy it.
Sorry, can I ask, Doc, sorry, before we go any further, Doc, can I just ask, is there an expiry date on that tweet from my dad in 1992? Because if it's still open, then, you know.
Oh, here's someone who's replied. Hey, Alan. I've just received them today. Thanks. And that's from... at Benjamin Cook.
No, the swine! Now I know what he's got that I haven't.
Yeah, your childhood.
You've always wondered that, isn't it? It sounds like it's your comic collection. Okay, so, shall we get into the flux?
Do we have to? I was really enjoying talking about other stuff, but there you go.
Right, well, we are gathered to talk about episodes 5 and 6 of The Flux. The final two episodes.
There's that sigh I know and dread.
Can I just say I was right in the last podcast when I described the Angel cliffhanger and I said that I thought it was going to be more like Han Solo being trapped in carbonite than any sort of bigger thing.
Yes.
Just somebody capturing her just to move her around, basically, just for, well, as the Angels themselves said at the start of episode 5, for transportation. And indeed, that's all it was. So yes, hooray, I was right.
It's a pity that issue was resolved almost immediately at the beginning of 5, wasn't it? And she didn't spend perhaps a few years as a wall decoration in Ian Levine's palace.
He's just the person to have her as a wall decoration, isn't he?
Who's got anything to say?
Yeah, I had a feeling the format of this and the fact that it was so badly hampered by, obviously, COVID restrictions and what have you, might end up coming to bite it on the bum. Let's say, for example, and I hate to compare it to previous eras, but I'm going to have to because it's the only thing I can compare it to. So let's say, for example, this was a Stephen Moffat climax, but it ended along a similar vein with so many plot threads all trying to be tied up at the end. If they didn't hit, or if some of them were still left unthreaded, then you could possibly forgive it as saying, oh, well, they had an awful lot of restrictions, they had an awful lot of things going against them here, and a loss of 4 episodes that would have allowed the story to breathe a bit more and all the rest of it. But the trouble is, I think a writer and a showrunner like Stephen Moffat or Russell T. Davis, or even going back further, even the likes of Graham Williams, Mark, would have earned that excuse and that acceptance. But I don't think Chris Chibnall has. So when it got to the end and I thought, well, this was just as I kind of expected this season would end, where it was all a bit garbled, all a bit rushed, all piled in together. There were a couple of, I'll get onto this later, but there's a couple of storylines that actually I think you could have done without, actually. And it would have made the season flow a lot better. And even though it's still a bit of an improvement on last year, the fact that Chibnall's finales, for me, not for anyone else, I'm just speaking completely from my perspective here, I don't think the previous two, the Battle of Avenue Q and the Timeless Children, didn't land for me. I didn't like them. I didn't think that they were a satisfying end to the series. So for a third one to go out, and for me still to come away thinking, but that hasn't answered all of the questions, and it doesn't look as though they're going to be answered in the next 3 specials either, they're going to be fairly separated, kind of leaves me feeling unsatisfied. And that's how I felt after episode 5, after being so happy about how good episode 4 was. For 5 and 6 to come along, and just for both of them, in my opinion, to be a mess with an awful lot of problems, was just incredibly disappointing.
It's a bit like that, isn't it, really? It is. Village of Angels has been, I guess it was probably going to happen that it would be slightly spoiled by the fact that it was tied up in this Timeless Child arc stuff again, which I've never liked. And whenever it appears, it always grates on me. So I obviously wasn't going to particularly enjoy these 2 episodes, I think. For example, the fact that Swarm said to the personification of time, I believe I'm saying that, he said, I give you the first Time Lord as a sacrifice. And I just say, I don't want the Doctor to be the first Time Lord.
No.
That always spoils it for me, really.
Do you know what? I think a better writer would have left that ambiguous and open, because it was hinted at in the 5th episode by Tek Tayoun that there's a multiverse that she's in control of. And in the back of my head, I was thinking and I was hoping and almost praying as a Doctor Who fan, leave this open-ended so then viewers can make up their own mind. Either the Fugitive Doctor and the Division are from another universe and this is all bled into one, and because the flux is happening, they've started to bleed through, whatever. You know, leave it open-ended. Let the viewer have ownership of their own idea as to what that means. But then they completely explain it away in the sixth episode. And I just think, I don't agree with people who, I saw some people online saying, you know, well, actually, Chris Chibnall has made the Doctor mysterious again. How? He's given away the backstory. All we don't know about is who were these, you know, how many previous lives were there and who were they? So what, I don't know. And I know the show always retcons itself as well, but in Time of the Doctor, the Doctor's on his last regeneration. The Time Lords give him more regenerations. And that came into my head when I was thinking about this whole plot narrative. And I just get the feeling that Chris Chibnall hasn't left it open-ended enough to satisfy me. And has left it very explicit in the show's backstory now that the Doctor was the first Time Lord of Gallifrey, the first Time Lord wherever, and they're all stemmed from the Doctor. I don't want to know that. Even the great mythical Cartmel master plan, you know, about the three at the start of Gallifreyan society, was it Rassilon, Omega, and the Other? You know, okay, the Other was intended to be the Doctor, but that's it. Just the Other.
Yes.
Somebody else there. It's not been explicitly. I mean, how can people say that Chibnall's given mystery back to the Doctor? He hasn't.
No, it's just giving us more information.
No.
And saying, oh, well, the Doctor's changed where the Doctor came from, and now you don't know where the Doctor came from,
no.
And you thought they came from Gallifrey. I mean, that's only a vague sort of shifting of the goalposts, really, isn't it? I mean, we didn't know anything about his life on Gallifrey before becoming the Doctor, really. You know, there's things been hinted at, you know, like Clara under the bed and stuff like that. But it's, I tend to agree. I'm not really a huge fan of secret organisations that are all powerful and shape events behind the scenes the whole time. Finding out that they have been. And like the Division either, because then that kind of throws into doubt everything in the Doctor's past stories. You don't know what's been manipulated by the Division, what hasn't. It's a bit like finding out, you know, I didn't like it when, you know, Clara was there telling the William Hartnell Doctor which TARDIS to steal either.
No.
I don't need stuff like that. I don't want to have that sort of...
No, not that.
And the thought that now the Division could have... how many times have the Division manipulated the Doctor to be where they wanted them to be? How many times were the Division behind the scenes in certain stories? And you can say, well, it's a clever device because you can use it to tie up continuity errors, or you can use it to explain things from past stories that don't make sense. I don't care about continuity errors from previous times. It doesn't really bother me. I don't know. Not sure I like the Division stuff a whole lot either. I think I kind of like the thought that the Doctor may have been like the Season 6B theory, which would tie in with the Division a bit, you know, where Time Lords have had the Doctor working for them. But it's the all-powerful, we've shaped all the events of the universe and things. It's just...
You see, what you're saying about Clara jumping into the time stream to be everywhere... annoyed me, because I didn't feel that she'd earned it.
No.
One, that she hadn't been there long enough, I think, for us to believe that she would seriously, potentially sacrifice herself for a guy she's not known that long. And two, I didn't feel she'd earned it in that, well, if she had to sacrifice herself, why would I particularly care? She's only been around five minutes.
Yeah, I think that's a leftover from Elizabeth Slater not being able to do it.
Yes, it was, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that if Chris Chibnall... it's happened a lot, hasn't it? They buggered up the numbering of the Doctors by introducing the War Doctor, because Eccleston wouldn't do a reappearance. But I feel that if Chris Chibnall is going to completely rewrite the sort of foundational history and lore of the show, he's got to do something to earn that right first.
This is what I mean, yeah.
I know that people used to complain, didn't they, that at the time...
Jeremy Bentham?
Mainly...
Jan Vidzebrowski.
What was his name? Yeah. Who did that main complaint that how appalling Deadly Assassin was, because it had stopped him believing that the Time Lords were all these mystical figures. But Bob Holmes wrote Assassin, I think, to be a good story. Not for the purpose of changing Time Lord lore or canon that happened, you know, as part of it. Whereas I feel that Chris Chibnall, the whole point of this series and the whole point of the Timeless Children was to change canon to his own liking. I don't think that... I don't think it was in order to write a good story. As you can tell these days, maybe Chris Chibnall thinks it's a good story. But I thought something... summing this season up, and maybe Chris Chibnall's work as a whole on Doctor Who, which was, with Chris Chibnall, stuff happens either because it needs to or because it sounds good. The first of those, it happens because it needs to in order to explain the plot, means the first of these doesn't require logic, and the second of them, stuff happens just because it sounds good, doesn't require any explanation. And I thought that sums up a fair bit of Chris Chibnall's work, because throughout this, and I'll take a little sabbatical from not commenting on what other people think about the show. Obviously, it's none of our business. We don't tend to do this consciously, I don't think. It's just that it's never particularly been something we thought, well, let's discuss that on the podcast, but what other people are saying. But there has been a lot throughout the first 5 episodes of this series. There's been a lot of the line, someone's saying, oh, I've just watched episode 1 or episode 5, and it was all over the place. And the answer seems to be, no, it's a 6-part serial. You can't say it's all over the place because you don't know. It could all be very neatly explained in part 6. You've got to wait to see that. Now, you could argue that given that we know it's Chris Chibnall writing this, that it's the, not just showrunning it, but writing it, that's the triumph of hope over experience. But when you reach the end of episode 5, Survivors of the Flux, and you knew there's just one episode left, I mean, how many people could have been under the impression that we were in the hands of a master of storytelling construction? With Stephen Moffat, you might have thought, I don't think you'd got this situation with Stephen Moffat, but you might have been able to say, it'll tie all the threads up of the plot up neatly and cleverly. We may not particularly like them, but it'll be done properly. Or with Russell T. Davies, you might think, oh, that was a bizarre plot, but he's likely to give us some, 9 times out of 10, an emotional kick that at least makes up for what we've been putting up with plot-wise. I have to say that having reached the end of episode 6, what was it called?
Oh, The Vanquishers.
The Vanquishers, thanks. I only watched it 2 days ago, I already can't remember.
Just call it chapter 6, Doc, then you're in safe ground.
I just felt, I can't believe we spent 6 weeks watching, podcasting about it, and in my situation, editing, it's sort of second-rate crap. If this had been a spin-off, like Class, I gave up on Class after about episode 2, I think, I wouldn't have kept watching it. Because it's just, it's only because it's Doctor Who. And there's a feeling that you can't miss it. I'm not sure if I still even cling to the argument that when people say, well, if you don't like it, why do you watch it? And the argument's always been, well, we watch it because it's a bit of a fundamental part of the childhood of many of us. And we always have this dream of however badly it's going. And this is why it's good to have changes of doctors. There's sometimes a new story each week.
Yeah.
It's because if you don't like it 1 week, or if you don't like this doctor, give it a while and there'll be a new type of story coming along next week, or a new doctor next year. And we subconsciously, I think, dream of this idea that we'll switch on Doctor Who and it'll be something like Blink or some of the stuff for me in Russell T. Davies' first series where it catapults you right back to your childhood and you find yourself loving Doctor Who again. And it reminds you of that simpler time of your childhood when you didn't have to worry about bills and the rent and tenants. I don't mean David Tennant, by the way. And I just think, well, why am I watching this now?
That's really interesting that you say that, because I actually spoke to a friend earlier about our experiences of this series. And I said to him, even after War of the Santarans, which I really liked, and Village of the Angels, which I think might possibly be Jodie's best story, and was a cracking good episode, I was still struggling to get excited. I don't think I've been excited to watch New Who since Jodie's first episode, actually. And I think that's a big problem. Because I, like yourself, like you were saying just then, Doc, one of the reasons why I keep coming back to Who is because it reminds me, you know, it is the nostalgia. It's the reason why we keep buying the classic series over and over again. It's the reason why we support the animation releases. It's the reason why people go out and buy the Terrence Dix Target book anthologies, even though they've probably already got them three times over. It's because we want a better version of what we had back then. And Doctor Who hasn't delivered that for quite some time now. And it's a problem. And equally a problem for me, and I know he has to toe the party line, but is Russell T Davies saying he's really enjoyed this and likes the idea of the division and the timeless child? That worries me a bit for where he could be going next. It's a similar problem I've had with Who. It's the similar problem to what I've had with Bond in recent years, where it's all become a bit too much about itself. Instead of just being that bit of escapism and having the adventure, you know, instead of the Doctor having a series of, you know, I didn't mind it. In fact, I really liked it when they were linked with a one, you know, a narrative over the season, like Bad Wolf, like Torchwood, like Mr. Saxon, like, all, you know, like the crack in Amy's wall. I really enjoy stuff like that. So the Flux had potential. But I just don't think, I mean, going back to my original point, I don't think Chibnall's earned the right to do what he's done with the backstory. There's been better writers than he and better showrunners than he who left that backstory well alone. Because at the time, and I've read it, you know, people like Stephen Moffat have said, you know, there's some things about Doctor Who that we should never know. You can hint to them, like the Doctor's name, like River Song knew the Doctor's name. We never heard it, did we? And I just think, I think too much has been said now. And I just, I'm not saying the mystery of the character has been completely ruined, but it's been tarnished. And I just don't know where it kind of goes after this. I want to see the Doctor and her companions, or his companions, obviously, you know, 14th Doctor on the way soon, just having adventures again. And then, yeah, maybe bringing it all together. There might be something linking them all together. But I just think in the hands of a lesser writer, and I'm sorry to, you know, I know I'm probably, I know I'm, you know, I write myself, but I don't know, I'm not qualified to say what I'm saying about Chris Chibnall. But then again, I'm not a spotty, bespeckled oik who went on telly and bemoaned a load of people well before my time anyway. So, you know, maybe he's had this coming. But the guy clearly, and I've said this on previous podcasts, he's clearly not enjoyed showrunning either. Everything from the fact that he said, oh, I said I'd do 3 years and get out, so I am. His miserable picture on the production notes in DWM, where it looks as though someone's, you know, just told him a relative's died and then delivered a 4-year gas bill to his door at exactly the same time. It's just, it doesn't look like he's enjoyed it. Therefore, I think if you can't enjoy your job, then you're not going to put your best work in or your best effort in, are you? I think looking back now at his episodes before he was showrunner, none of them were the best in their season. Like Stephen, you know, Stephen Moffat, his episodes were the highlight of the RTD years. They just, I know stuff like Parts of the Ways and Dalek were great. But you look back, you know, Empty Child, Doctor Dances, Girl in the Fireplace, Blink, Silence in the Library. Maybe Chris Chibnall was onto a loser right from the off because he was following Stephen Moffat. Maybe he's the David Moyes to Moffat Sir Alex Ferguson. Do you know what I mean?
Well, do you mean Chris Chibnall's going to come back after a couple of seasons and he's going to be really good?
Yeah, on a different show, which is going to be on at the same time as Doctor Who and take its viewers away. Yeah, probably.
It's weird. I think Chris Chibnall's very good at coming up with events and plot points, but I don't think he connects things together very well. I don't think you get to see... I don't feel his work always functions like, certainly in this series, like a story. And I think that's what I've been missing. That's why it's become, I found those last two episodes in particular a real drag to get through because they're chopping and changing, especially episode 6, the editing on it. I know it's all part of the design stuff, but it's edited so fast between scenes. I actually found, for me personally, I find it tiring.
Mm.
I think I was about a quarter of an hour into chapter 6, and I did, and it's probably one of the first times I've ever thought it. I thought, oh, do you know what? I could just turn this off now and go and do something else.
Yeah.
Like, why don't you turn your television set and go and do something less boring instead?
There are times when I've watched Doctor Who when I've checked the clock to see how much more of it is left, when I've been doing it because I'm really enjoying this. I hope there's more than just 5 minutes left tonight. I hope it's got, you know, there's like quite a big chunk left. And there are times when I check the clock and think, God, when is this going to end?
Oh, I thought you were going to say there's times I was just looking at the clock and occasionally just check Doctor Who. Oh, it's still on. Oh,
God, imagine.
Problem for me with the chopping and changing is they're chopping and changing between stories I'm not particularly interested in.
Yes, yes. You can't get invested into a story or even a character. I think it's showing that one of the best characters that's come out of this was introduced in Chapter 4, Village of the Angels, Eustacius Jericho. And he's one of the few characters that I actually felt a connection to, that I actually felt invested in. And I think that's because we met him and we went through a proper story with him. Obviously, it helps that, you know, the performance by Kevin McNally was great. It helped, perhaps, that there was another writer on that episode. So his character seemed, it just, none of the others, I know I'm supposed to care about Vinda and Bell, but I just, you know, I couldn't really.
I'll tell you what, I felt as though their inclusion was to give it a more of a sort of a human element to the story. But the trouble there is that you've already got a new double act in Dan and Claire.
Yes.
Doing almost exactly the same thing.
Hmm. Diane.
Oh, sorry, Diane. Sorry, Claire's Professor Jericho's friend, isn't she? But she was there too. I actually think that the two plot strands I thought you could completely do away with was the Grand Serpent and UNIT, which was just, didn't need to be there. And actually, and Vinda and Bell's storyline didn't need to be there either. Now, when you're in a series which is going to be truncated by COVID restrictions, you really what you need to do is you need to hone in on the plot more. Not have loads of other little plots going on all around the place.
You don't need unnecessary characters, do you?
No. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And the trouble with 5 and 6 for me was they're a bit like 1 and 3. Where it was just garbled and it was plot dumps. And I could forgive the first episode because it's the first episode, you know, it's setting up the series. But for me, 3, 5 and 6, I just found, well, actually 5 and 6 were almost unbearable, to be honest with you. I mean, I know some people will say, oh, well, if you don't have the Grand Serpent storyline, then you won't have Kate Stewart coming back.
No.
Kate Stewart didn't do anything.
No, she really didn't.
She pointed a gun in the tunnels. She sits down with the Grand Serpent and says, oh, you're not going to get away with this. And then just sort of wanders home.
Yes.
Doesn't rally the UNIT troops. Doesn't call Osgood. Doesn't call, you know, okay, she calls Osgood, I'm going dark. I bet Oscar was on the other side going, what does that mean? Is she going emo? Is she going, what's she doing? She joined a goth cult? I don't know. And that was a big, big problem. Big problem. And the Vinda and Bell stuff, I mean, I'm completely outraged, really, to tell you the truth, that the baby didn't turn out to be 9, but there you go.
Sometimes read the Guardian's review of each episode by episode. And after episode 5, the reviewer described Kate as steely. And after 6, he described her as imperious. But she didn't do anything. She's all talk.
Hmm.
What's the first thing that she says whenever she appears? She's constantly boasting about her family connection with UNIT. And to be fair, that seems the only point in her being in UNIT, because she never actually seems to do anything. I hadn't realised before how much like the 13th Doctor Kate Stewart is.
Mm.
It's all talk and no agency.
Yep.
What you might think is, oh, that's great. The 13th Doctor can meet Kate Stewart, that she'll meet the Doctor in her new incarnation. Did she show any surprise that the Doctor was not only now a different person, but a woman? No surprise at all.
Well, you never did when Capaldi turned up in... she turned up in that as well. She has previous on that. In that scene in Death in Heaven, where she pops up in the last episode, she just gets on with it. I don't know whether it's because these doctors are known to them, to UNIT, or whether because they've met before. I really don't know. But yeah, she didn't need to be there. She really didn't need to be there. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how this would have been as a 10-part series with a few more writers in there, if it hadn't been COVID restricted. Yeah. But like I said, I can't really give Chris Chibnall the credence because he's Doctor Who's disappointed me quite a lot in the past. So he hasn't earned that. I don't want to sound wanky by saying he hasn't earned that trust from me, but he hasn't really.
No, but I think it's reasonable.
I mean, the quality of his writing, I've seen people say, well, you probably just didn't understand the episode. And I don't think it is that. I think there's genuine problems with his actual... He leaves these huge gaps between things happening. Things happen just because, and things happen that don't entirely make sense. I mean, I don't understand if division has always existed between universes all this time. So it's never been in, it's existed outside the universe. Why is it now moving into another universe? Why does it need to do that? I mean, to sum it all up, I would say that scene with Tecteon in Chapter 5 is a prime example of this, because Division spent all this time shaping the events of the universe, primarily to keep Gallifrey safe, and for whatever other reasons, they aren't really fully explained. But Tecteon's decided that having the Doctor in Universe 1 is a mistake, so she's going to destroy that universe to stop the Doctor finding out about Division. Which I guess is kind of like wiping your hard drive. But she's also going to, for some reason, release Azure and Swarm from imprisonment so that they can go after the Doctor as well. And then she gets the angels to capture the Doctor and bring her to Division, which is the one place where she can stop the flux.
Yeah.
I mean, why didn't she just capture the Doctor in the first place? Why didn't she just send the Weeping Angels out to capture the Doctor? Why did she have to do the whole thing with the Flux? And if Carvanista's the only person alive who can tell the Doctor about Division, why can't she just activate the thing in Carvanista's head? In fact, why doesn't she do that anyway if she knows he's helping him? And also this, I mean, Tecteon basically says, I've brought you to Division so that you can't stop the Flux. And then she says, but if you want, I'll put you back in the universe to stop the Flux, except you can't. It's like, what?
Yeah. Or you can rejoin me.
Yes.
Which means you have taken her into the new universe.
I released the Flux and Azure and Swarm to kill you because you're too dangerous to Division to exist. But also, come and join us. It's not, what? You know, it's just, it's not clear plotting, is it? It's muddy.
There's no credible motive for destroying the universe, is there?
No, it's muddy.
We're destroying the universe because you inspire people. You make them question and rise up. Now this is, I would have thought the whole point of not liking Division is because it's controlling people. If Division needs to be opposed, it ought to be because it's dictatorial and totalitarian. Because it gives people no say in how it acts to make major changes. It's the Time Lords making decisions for everyone else because they think they know best. Not that those decisions are evil, per se, such as, let's destroy the universe for no very good reason, but because those decisions are taken arrogantly. That's a challenging idea and question, not do you think wickedness is a bad thing? I don't think it's credible to think that the Time Lords will set up Division in order to be tyrannical. They might say, well, set up Division, say, to stop other species learning about time travel. Now, that might be credible. Or we'll do it to stop this happening. Or, given that I imagine that we think it must have been the Division who, in Genesis, send the Doctor to try and stop the development of the Daleks. Now, that's not a wicked thing to do, is it? It might be misguided. But it's generally, it's clearly... You've got this saying, haven't you, that every villain is a hero of his own story. You know the, what's not the peep show, what was the comedy series they did together.
Mitchell and Webb look.
Yeah, Mitchell and Webb look.
In Mitchell and Webb.
Oh, are you talking about the Nazis?
Yeah, where they got the Nazis, and they're saying, one of them says to the other, I've just noticed, you noticed these skull and crossbones on our caps. Are we the baddies?
Yeah, it's classic.
Now, of course, we all laugh at that, but actually, it's a very good point, isn't it? That most baddies, unless there's someone like Davros, who thinks, I'd kill everyone just to show that I could, or the Daleks, who kill everyone because they
aren't Daleks.
A race of racists. The Time Lords would be thinking, this is why I don't particularly like the idea of making the Time Lords into baddies. The fact that they're baddies should be the fact that they're boring, or that they don't like interfering, or that they all stand aside when they're suffering.
This all sounds very close to home.
It shouldn't be that they're actually plotting to destroy the universe. And, you know, we'll stop you because you inspire people. You make them question and rise up. Well, she doesn't. She doesn't go around planet Earth, does she, making, in dictatorships, making people rise up against dictators. She stopped alien invasions.
No, she didn't even do anything in Kablam, did she? So, you know.
Yeah, she doesn't inspire Amazon customers, does she? And it just seems there's no reason to do it. So, essentially, why is Tecton destroying the universe? Because she can, or because she needs to be able to do that in order to justify doing stupid things like introducing the Flux.
Yeah.
I must say, when we actually saw what Division was, I had no concept of the sheer, you know, the power of Division and the unlimited resources at their command until Tecton uttered those terrifying words. Ood, guard the Doctor. Which has only got one hand free because it's carrying its translator thing in one of them. I think I just said on Twitter that's Ood, guard the Doctor is on a par with saying, what was it, Belal, you know, from Death to the Daleks. Belal, begin the torture with the thumbscrews and call me when she's cracked. It's just not believable. And it makes Tecton a fool, which shouldn't be. It just seems very, very bizarre.
There's too much as well with Chris Chibnall's writing. Seems we're just having a full broadside of it. Why not? Because he seems to take a lot of lazy shortcuts to me. I mean, like, so much stuff happens and it's kind of, just because, you know, I mean, like, why does Azur single out Diane in the first episode saying what fun we're going to have? Why has that happened? There's no explanation for it, is there? How come Diane ends up alone in Passenger? I don't know. How come Vinda turns up at Atropos? How come Dan returns to Liverpool and the first and the only people he meets outside happen to be his parents? Why do Sontaran door locks made for Sontaran hands open for human hands? Why are there lit candles in a sealed tomb? Why is it easier to recall Bell's ship rather than just recall the one that's drifting? And all of it seems to be, just because that's what I want. And it's none of these things feel earned. It's just like, it reminds me of my brother back in the 80s doing a Rubik's Cube. And I remember my brother coming out of his room saying, hey, look, I've done your Rubik's Cube. And all the sides were all the matching colours. And he got it all lined up right. And I was like, oh, how did you do it? And I said, show me how you did it. And he was like, I can't. I just, you know, I wouldn't be able to do it again. It will take too long. And I took it off him. And the stickers started falling off. It turned out he'd just taken the stickers off and he'd replaced them. He'd done none of the actual work. But at the end, it sort of looked like a completed Rubik's Cube. And that's what a lot of this feels like to me. Yeah, there we are. There's all the bits there.
He'd taken all the stickers off and then just put them all back on in the right order.
Yes. And that's what it feels like with a lot of Chibnall's writing. Like, he doesn't do the twisting and the turning and the working out. He just does the, I'll just move that sticker onto that side. That'll do.
Yeah, that's what you mean.
I was really hoping then, Mark, to have another one of your Chris Chibnall breaks into your house analogies.
Chris Chibnall broke into my house and he said, you know that Rubik's Cube yours, I'll do that for you. And I said, oh yeah, all right then. Okay, shivers, off you go. And he took my Rubik's Cube and he went into the toilet and locked the door. I thought, funny.
Oh, brilliant.
There's a point, I think, in... I'll check notes. There's a point in The Vanquishers when the Doctor splits into three and she appears. Yes. And she starts to sort of like try to work out how it's happened. Because in my head, it could happen that one splits off to go to the TARDIS because the Ood's found out where her TARDIS is. There's no explanation as to why a version ends up on the Lupari ship Vinda and Carvanista. And the Doctor starts saying, oh, that's possibly because of something to do with Swarm and because I was outside of the... Oh, and then almost in a side to the audience, let's not think about it. That sums it up, doesn't it? It's just, how can the Doctor split into three? Her answer, let's not think about it.
When the Doctor discovers that the Lupari have been annihilated, that Carvanista is the last one, and she dismisses it to the rest of the gang.
In one of the nastiest ways imaginable, yeah.
As he's having a bad day and pats him on the head. That's one of the most undoctorish. That's almost like trying to strangle Perry in the TARDIS. It's one of the most undoctorish. You know, this...
So it's a bit like 13 with Graham.
Well, this is the thing. I don't quite know where the 13th Doctor's... Do I mean moral compass? I don't know where the head's at, I guess. Because not only that, but then you also have her committing genocide against the Daleks and the Cybermen. Yes, I know they're Daleks and the Cybermen and the Sontarans. But it's so cold.
I wonder if Chris Chibnall's deliberately written this Doctor as a sociopath. Just, you know, four genocides.
Oh, she's horribly unlikable.
The Master's a psychopath, the Doctor's a sociopath.
Yeah.
She's horribly unlikable. I almost feel like the whole story with the Fugitive Doctor has been, for me, one of Jodie's downfalls, actually, because I think Jo Martin has... Even in the four scenes that she's had playing the Doctor? I mean, you can literally count them on one hand.
Yeah.
She's been authoritative. She's been no nonsense. She's had a glimmer of... Yeah, you know, she's had that twinkle that Hartnell had. Jodie's missing all of that. Jodie, to me, has been doing a bad David Tennant impression since 2018. And the bit when it's talking about fancying herself as well, I just thought, oh, aren't I cute or whatever, and pulling that stupid funny face. I thought...
Oh, and the Scrabble gabble.
Oh, get over it. I never want another actor or actress in the role again who's only ever seen David Tennant as the Doctor. And I don't just mean that because I don't like David Tennant's Doctor. I mean that because you either go in cold or you go in knowing the whole thing. Get the full breadth of the role. Because she's just the 10th Doctor again, isn't she?
Well, that's down to the showrunner, though, isn't it, I think?
I think it's her as well. I think it's her too. Genuinely.
I think it's the way she's written. I think she's far too self-regarding for a Doctor. I know, Capaldi was a bit like it towards the end. With his Am I a Good Man thing.
Mm.
But he did get over that. But it's... I don't know. Oh, and can we not have pop culture references or just like that Paul Hollywood handshake? It was just what? I don't even know what that means. It's just
I missed that. Sorry, there was a pull.
She grabs hold of Joseph Williamson's hand in the tunnels, gives it a vigorous shaking, and pants at him. Paul Hollywood handshake.
Hello.
How did that not get cut?
I mean, it's not even like with when the first Doctor does the space-time visualizer, he looks back in time. If I'm looking at the Beatles, now you can imagine, in 50 years' time, people will still be aware of the Beatles. Who's going to know who Paul Hollywood is? And of course, it's a scouser Paul Hollywood, isn't it? Which may explain it. I think it's interesting what you say about the Doctor being self-regarding, Mark. In that you notice who's the person she talks to most? Herself. You know, she's constantly having a conversation with herself. But I think it's also true what you said about this is what the showrunner's for, is to correct this sort of thing. What's the point of having an Uber fan as a showrunner if not to correctly sort of thing. I noticed that when Tectoon is telling her all the wicked things that the Vision's been doing, the Doctor appears appalled.
As our ability to travel grew and our horizons broadened, Division kept pace. The number of operatives grew.
What did those operatives do?
Anything we needed. Guided and shaped events.
Interfered in contravention of all Time Lord directives.
Interfering in contravention of all Time Lord directives. Now, she's angry. The Doctor wouldn't be angry about that because he doesn't believe in the non-interference thing. Now, the thing is, you could say, if that was said in a questioning, sort of cynically questioning tone, oh, interfered in contravention of all Time Lord directives. In other words, saying, you know, what have you become? That would work. Now, clearly, I would suggest if Tennant was delivering that line, he would know that the whole basis of the Doctor leaving Gallifrey in the first place was that he opposed the Time Lord's policies of non-interference. He wasn't in favour of them. I don't expect her to know that, because she's obviously not a fan of the show. But why hasn't Chris Chibnall or someone told her, no, don't say the line like that? And it just seems... oh dear. I don't like to... She did an interview recently, hasn't she, Jodie, about leaving? And I'd not read it, because I thought something sounded quite sad that she... I saw, you know, this interview being advertised, and just a quote from it. It was, I do worry that I've made it more difficult for other actresses to play the Doctor. And I thought, oh, that's quite sad if she feels like that. But I have nothing against her at all. It's just the characterisation she's been given.
Yeah, I think she's great. And she's been a great ambassador for the show.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Screen and stuff, hasn't she? She's been brilliant. She's obviously an absolutely lovely person. Mm. And some of her scenes have been brilliant, and we've seen what she's capable of doing. Usually, when she's one-on-one with another great actor, those seem to bring out the best in her. But it's too much, and, you know, again, I'm going to complain about the hologram, which was just seemed like an absolute caricature of 80% of her performance, which is her standing there explaining things with her hands chopping around.
Yeah.
You know, that's not her fault. That's what she's been given to do.
Yes, exactly. At the same time, we don't trash Simon the Rani and feel that we've got to apologise that, oh, it's not Sylvester we dislike. We don't trash Time Lash and apologise that, oh, it's not Colin we dislike as a person. Now, I understand it's different because she's the first woman to play the Doctor. But I think this sort of thing has to be said. And you've already said, Mark, Joe Martin doing it.
Oh, it's Hayden.
Yeah.
Well, she had about 5 minutes since across the whole 3 years. Sorry, Hayden. Have you got people saying, oh, she's amazing? Well, I suspect a lot of that is that they'll say, they've got Finger Mouse on, playing a previous Doctor, and they say it was amazing. But I can't work out, I mean, you know, but I always, where possible, take the opportunity to bang on about how bad I think the acting of the Doctor and the TARDIS crew is. But I can't entirely work out, is it who they've cast? Is it how they're being directed? Or is it the lines? Now, I could think, oh, well, Kevin McNally's Professor Jericho is entirely different. But then, were his lines being written by Chris Chibnall or by Maxine Alderton? Because I think we came away from Village of the Angels thinking, what an amazing character and performance. Start of the next episode, where Christopher Chibnall was writing on his own, he's become a comic foil. Not even for the Doctor, which might have some kudos. He's become a comic foil for Yaz.
Mm.
He's falling through that hole in the pyramid or wherever they are. And he thought, bloody hell, what are they doing? So I think it has to be a combination of the two. Of the three, is the writing and the casting and the direction of the actors. Because the directors are constantly changing, aren't they? But not necessarily in this series. And I don't see any improvement in how things are being done. I saw when she was being interrogated, come tortured by, I'm not going to say the Grand Serpent, it sounds so silly, say Prentice, which I thought was clever. Because if you spell it in a particular way, Prentice is an anagram of Serpent. I thought that was, so that was the best acting I've seen her do in Doctor Who.
This is why I don't think it is the writing exclusively. Sometimes I think it is the decision of the actor and also the direction. Because like you said, you know, Jo Martin's lines have been written by Chris Chibnall. They weren't written by anybody else.
No.
And that's the thing. And she has had moments where she has had gravitas. Ironically, I think this season, her two best episodes were the ones when she was away from the companions. And she was authoritative and she was snappy, you know, with the dialogue and the wit. She was the Doctor in those. But these ones, just the info dump episodes, I think she's been appalling.
Mm. Yeah.
And it really is. And I think for me, you know, I've kind of almost been scared to say it, I think, because of the public, especially the online reaction, whenever you seem to sort of criticise Jodie Whittaker, it's a, oh, well, you're a sexist.
It's got dragged into the culture wars thing, hasn't it, a bit?
It has. But I don't like her, Doctor, and I don't think she was a particularly good fit for the role. I feel like I can say that now, because I've seen three full series of her as the Doctor, and her high points are greatly outstripped by the low points. And she's been a fantastic ambassador. She's a great actress in her own right. But some people just aren't right for these roles. And I just don't think she was right for it. Jo Martin from the outset would have been amazing. And you would have a very, you know, a brilliant Doctor in her, actually, I think, because of the way she chose to play what she was given. But I think Jodie's kind of, I think in a way she has messed it up a little bit. I kind of feel bad saying it, really, because every time I see something that I don't like her doing, I think of that little girl on Children in Need a couple of years ago when she was in tears and sees her. And I think, oh, I do feel bad thinking this, which I don't feel like for any other Doctor at all. But then I think every other Doctor, I mean, is she my least favourite? I don't know. I don't know, but she's certainly down there.
I even ask myself whether it's that you've got predominantly male writers. And not only male writers, but the sort of men who were Doctor Who fans. Is it that they don't know how to write a female action hero?
Yeah.
But then, you know, he's also writing crappy lines for Ryan and for male characters. I don't think it can help that she's given so little agency, isn't she? It's arguable that this Doctor often amounts to little more than a string of empty boasts and threats. Can you imagine that all a villain would really need to do in reply to one of the Doctor's threats is say, oh, go on then.
Yeah.
And what would she actually do? You'd get a sonic screwdriver out. Remember when she was on that sort of double mirrored beach in Village of the Angels and she was talking to the angel that was inside Claire's head?
This is me serving you notice. I want you out of here now.
If the angel had just said, oh, go on then, or what?
Yeah.
I mean, what would the Doctor have done?
It's the same at the end of that episode as well, isn't it? Because she's standing there and she says, right, okay, all of you, you let Claire go or I'll do something to you. And it's like, well, what?
Yeah.
It's interesting we said about predominantly male writers writing for her because, interestingly enough, I think Maxine Alderton, I think the two episodes that she's written... Well, I think I said it last episode. I think probably my two favourite episodes of the entire Jodie era.
Village of the Angels and Villa Diodati, yeah.
Yeah, and Rosa was fantastic. And of course, that was Mallory Blackman. So maybe it is the way male writers have written her. I'm just not sure. Joy Wilkinson did a really good job on The Witchfinders.
Yes.
Yes, that was a good one.
The scene where she's tied to the tree and she's talking to James the First and giving him a bit of a dressing down, even though she's the one who's restrained, was really good.
Yeah.
You know, going back a little further, I always thought it was a shame they didn't invite Sarah Dollard back to do any of Jodie's stories, considering she wrote stuff like Thin Ice.
Mm.
She did Thin Ice in Peter Capaldi's run and Face the Raven as well, which I thought was pretty good. So I just, maybe the balance hasn't been there, but I know where Jodie Whittaker's coming from with that comment. I just think it's such a shame. It's just such a shame. But, again, for anyone who's enjoyed it, and I think we said this before, even though we haven't as a whole this era, you know, fantastic for anyone who has. Good for you. You know, you've found an era which you like. There are people who adore the Colin Baker era. I don't. You know, I adore the Patrick Troughton era and the first half of the Tom Baker era and Matt Smith's era, you know, they're, and Christopher Eccleston's series, you know, they're kind of, they're the ones that I will cling on to.
Mm.
The meat in the Pertwee years, let's say, you know, they're the ones I hold dear. Other people might hate them. That's absolutely fine. This is just what I think to it. But I just think it's such a shame that this seems a bit of a wasted opportunity. And I feel I can say that now, like I said, because we've had three whole seasons of it. And there have been highlights. There's been great episodes. But it just hasn't... I can honestly see this being... These will be the DVDs that I will not go to very much.
Yeah.
As the years roll on. And it's just a wasted opportunity. It's disappointing. Oh, is there anything I liked? I'm trying to think now.
What did you think of the whole companions travelling around the world like Indiana Jones thing? I should ask that, should I? Because I know what you think of the guru.
Oh,
that was funny.
I liked the guru.
Not the guru, but oh, you didn't.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed him.
After episode 5 had finished, we went onto Twitter. We took a screenshot of the closing credits where it had said Santarans were created by Robert Holmes. Oh, the angels were created by Stephen Moffat. And we added in Guru created by Jimmy Perry and David Croft, who were the guys who wrote It Ain't Our Fotman, which I thought with that voice he was talking, said, oh, it's Punker Waller off It Ain't Our Fotman. You know, when you think something, oh, it's just a little joke, and you're astonished. You say something you think is profoundly intelligent on Twitter, and two people will like it. You'll say something you think, oh, that's mildly amusing, and about 100 people will like it. It surprises you. Someone replied, who was clearly someone who was, she was either a relatively new fan or just a new Who fan, replied, oh, I didn't realise he'd been in the show previously. What was he in?
Oh,
dear.
You got a few answers from people actually who just were like, oh, I hadn't noticed that. And they have to put that on. Yeah. They have to credit the creators. And
yes, that was it's a legal obligation.
Yeah.
So we were talking about the companions going around the earth like Indiana Jones.
I'm not a big fan of Chibnall's comedy generally. I think one of the only things I've really laughed at has been the has been Dan saying, I can't live in that. Which has really tickled me. But
not quite sure how they escaped from the village that's stranded in the middle of space.
Well, presumably the village got put back.
Well, the angel said to the doctor, your friends are marooned.
I think that probably means... I mean, it's not made explicit, but you have to presume they mean in time as opposed to space.
With things like that, I would... Right, I'd top in my head, just think, oh, well, I don't really mind that they're not... Probably it's just, you know, it's zapped back to its normal place now the doctor's gone. It's only when I'm not particularly enjoying the story that I start nitpicking at things like that.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? I didn't get why they went to the Great Wall of China to write those words. Again, that's...
I think it's the idea that you can be seen from space, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but the Great Wall of China can't be seen from space, though. That's like a myth, isn't it? Again, it's just because, isn't it? And how they managed to travel that far around the world in that time with whatever money they've got or not got.
And all to do something was that the doctor said, travel around the world and find out if someone has ever predicted that the flux is going to destroy the Earth a few thousand years later. What? I mean, a character like Yaz, who's, you get the impression that she only became a police cadet because there were no jobs flipping burgers. Oh, it's just weird. And then, talking about the companions, the fairly worthless trio of Belle, Vindra and Diane survive, and they kill off the professor. Now, I don't know if that's because, you know, if you want to have returning characters in the future, it's a decent bet that actors like the actors playing Belle, Vindra and Diana are far more likely to be free from other jobs than Kevin McNally is. He doesn't get that great send-off line, doesn't he? What an awfully big adventure.
Yeah.
But they can't even allow him a great death, can they? You know, sacrificing himself to save his friends. He dies because he just drops his transmat ring accidentally.
Yeah, it's very arbitrary, isn't it?
And Yaz and Dan, having spent 3 years travelling around the world with him, they're either unmoved by his death or, you know, they're not given the opportunity to just show they are moved. Poor Kevin.
What did we think about the Doctor dropping the fob watch inside the TARDIS?
I thought that was okay because...
Yeah.
She's taken control of her memories.
Mm.
She doesn't need, you know, they're there if she wants them. And so that's fine. We don't have to look at them. It's all yeah. right. I didn't mind that. I mean, one of the things I do think the basic ending of this plot-wise was okay. I was happy about the fob watch and the memories being stored away in the TARDIS. I thought that's fine. And even the stuff with the antimatter, the flux being antimatter, that actually scientifically all made sense, even the putting the spaceships in front of it, because antimatter, when it connects to matter, annihilates both of them, but in an equal amount. So therefore, that second load of flux that's been sent out is obviously massive, but every time any of it touches matter, then the flux decreases. And so there's obviously been enough sent to take out everything in the universe,
yeah.
but the Ood back in Division has done something, which we don't know what, but so to lessen it, so there's less antimatter. It's the flux isn't as big as it was. So the ships do slow it down, and then they use the passenger just to mop up the rest of it. Although I still don't understand how the passenger suddenly got there, suddenly pops up.
Yeah.
That's another sort of just because, really. I don't know.
And nothing's changed, has it? The flux occurred, and nothing's been put back right.
No.
It just happened.
As far as we know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's going to be addressed in the next three episodes. I hope so.
So in the new year, is the Doctor going to be working in a mostly destroyed universe?
Well, you guess so, wouldn't you? Who knows? Like I say, sometimes things just get hand-waved away and forgotten about, don't they? So
I think this is the silliness of doing things like... I mean, this whole thing in Legopolis of the Master destroying a third of the universe. Mm-hmm. And seeing who does that, okay, you might think it's over the top.
Mm.
But you just imagine that you could never again have the Doctor trying to do his, I really miss him. I'd try to save his life. The Master, because he means so much to me. That would sort of turn him against you, wouldn't it?
Mm.
But it's the way it's written. You got trillions of people dying. You got 7 billion Lupari dying. And I felt nothing. You can't just write a line saying that the universe is being destroyed. And I'm not saying, therefore, you must show the universe being destroyed for me to believe it. You've got to make me care. But then I never really believed that there was a whole race out there which was species bonded to every human being.
No.
That's just nonsense. I didn't believe in all 7 billion of them being thrown out of airlocks, or care.
Can I just say as well, I don't mean to sound terribly woke or anything, but I do feel sometimes that Carvanista does get all the dog jokes at him the whole time.
I know!
That feels like...
He's just lost all his people, and Dan is joking about giving him a biscuit.
Yeah, and it feels, I don't know, I hate to say, but it feels like slightly racist.
Potato heads, at least you could understand in that, you know, they're bastards. Do you remember when the Zygon two-parter, when they were all refugees on Earth? Mm. And the Doctor was calling them things like a blobby.
Look, Aidmar, are you okay? I think you're ingenious. Pretending to be a couple of seven-year-olds is a splendid way to conceal your blobbiness. But let's not pretend. You're very blobby. In fact, you two are the big blobs, and you are not patrolling the ceasefire. There are other factions. I know there are other blobby factions that you don't control.
Oh, it's strange, isn't it? It's funny, I suppose, for kids, but...
How did we feel to the Santaran with an addiction to chocolate, then?
Oh,
please.
I didn't really get that whole corner shop thing in the first place. What was the explanation for that, that they needed something?
They needed chocolate.
So all the ships were parked at corner shops rather than places that would have more, like supermarkets and factories. And why weren't they parked there? Why weren't they parked at shopping centres and things like that? I mean, you did see them in the shopping centre, but what's the thing with the corner shops? I didn't really get it, really, other than it allowed them to do that scene, which I thought was just... I mean, the tin hat of that was the Sontaran at the end going, chocolate! It's just, oh, God. But, you know, some people will really enjoy that and will have thought it was funny, but I just... It didn't work for me. It's not.
You see, this line seems to have become common currency, that the Sontarans have always been comedy aliens ever since the Time War. And I thought, it's the first I ever heard of this.
Well, they were funny in the Time Warrior, but like I said before, like Lynx turns up and he puts his little flag in the earth, and it pops open, and there's a little fanfare, and he declares himself. It is funny, but...
well, that's mocking imperialism, isn't it? It's not,
yeah.
It's not because exactly. He's a comedy figure.
No.
And even if it was, it's a joke that's over and done with in 5 seconds from a writer like Bob Holmes. It's, if you'd excuse me exploiting my northern vowels to the utmost here, it's a nudge, not a shove. Planting a flag is a way of looking at his actions as ridiculous, not that he's a clown. It's not like he landed on Earth and said, "Oh, where's the nearest chocolate shop?" Is it?
No.
I think that's similar to the idea that Robert Holmes had turned the Time Lords into doddery old men, which is based entirely on those two doddery old Time Lords having a conversation in a changing room for 2 minutes. And if they are comedy aliens, why produce them as the cliffhanger threat at the end of episode 5? No one's going to go away from that thinking, oh no, how awful. They're going to think of jokes all next week. I've never seen any evidence before of people saying online anything that, oh, we always thought the Sontarans were comedy characters.
Well, I mean, they have been a lot in New Who.
And that was another line. The Doctor says, I've seen a lot of species make alliances with the Sontarans. And 5 minutes later, she says, Sontarans never offer alliances. What are they doing?
Yeah, but there's a lot of stuff that doesn't follow and doesn't scan, isn't there? Like I said, that whole conversation with Tektaean, where 1 minute she's trying to destroy the Doctor, the other minute she's trying to get on board. And then the same with the spaceships crashing into the Sontaran spaceship. You know, Dan wiped them out by crashing them into them with a spaceship. But then the Doctor does it. And fair enough, they might have, after Dan had crashed into them, maybe they did get their shields up and be more proactive defensively. But, you know, the Doctor just says, well, of course they'd have to have precautions against people crashing into them. And it's like, why didn't she just say, well, they wouldn't let it happen twice, rather than leave it feeling all fudged? So what did you think of the Sontarans, Aidan?
I don't know. I'm in two minds about it, really. There's a part of me that thinks it was nice light relief, and there's another part of me thinking the Doctor and her friends were taking advantage of someone with an addiction. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure what to think about that moment, really. I can see how it would be funny for an awful lot of people watching, but I think maybe for some others, they'll possibly think, oh, all right, well, thank you, Doctor.
Talking about going over the top with millions and millions of, oh, there's millions doing this and millions doing that. I'm really being turned off this CGI thing of ranks and ranks of hundreds of identical aliens marching along. Like they did it with the Sontarans in the shopping centre and the Cybermen on that destroyed planet that Bell sees. And they don't look CGI in that you're thinking, oh, they're dodgy, don't they? But every time they do it, it just screams CGI. They're all identical. They're all in neat lines. And, there we are.
I've got a problem with the Sontarans now, because every time the Doctor will come up against them, I'll just think, just wait until they need to recharge and switch them off. At the end of that second episode, that was the one downfall, or one of the only downfalls in that episode for me. They've weakened the Sontarans now, but anyway.
What they could have done, the Doctor should have given him, in that corner shop, the Doctor should have given him a Toblerone. And then watch him bite down on it and destroy his upper palate.
Very true.
One thing that was slightly different here is that for the first time, other characters almost got more clunky lines than the Doctor did.
Hmm.
Yaz, in that pyramid, they're all then saying you...
And you still haven't figured out how to balance the counterweight pulley properly.
And what was the other line she had?
It seems the Sontarans are using human operatives to find the exact moment and place the final flux event will begin.
But simultaneously, they're organising a truce meeting with Daleks and Cybermen.
No one says simultaneously. Unless they're writing a book or a letter. Even Belle struggles to talk to Tigmi convincingly, which is...
That huge monolith doesn't look foreboding at all.
No one talks like that. I thought what I did think was funny with the whole thing of talking to yourself is that, Vinda's creeping around all that wrecked planet where there's all these circles of people standing around things that look like mini TARDIS consoles. And Azure and Swarm standing in a corner, and he's sort of creeping stealthily around so that he won't disturb them. And he's doing his expositing out loud. He's not doing it as thinking as a voice in his head. You can see it's actually moving. So he's actually doing exposition while talking to himself in a situation where he could die if anyone realises he's there.
Yeah.
I know, it's almost like shooting fish in a barrel, criticising Chibnall's dialogue, isn't it? But that's no reason to stop you doing it.
What did anyone think of the Grand Serpent?
Pointless. Shouldn't have been in it.
Pointless, but I like the actor and the acting.
Mm.
But what is the point of him? Yeah.
Well, basically he was the master in all but name, wasn't he?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yes. I think a lot of people are probably thinking, oh, is he going to be the master?
Well, yeah, and they set that up with him saying, I prefer to be called, didn't they? Which was clearly master... Oh, no! Masturbating.
But talking of earning things, I don't think he'd done anything to earn screwing with UNIT. So now UNIT's now been founded by an idiot general.
Mm-hmm.
Who's, despite the myth that probably has come from historical revisionism of the First World War, fools don't tend to become generals because nation states, on the whole, don't want to lose wars. They might fight war badly, but he's not some upper-class idiot as founded UNIT. I didn't care too much about the whole Lethbridge-Stewart voice and Lethbridge-Stewart suddenly being a corporal. Corporals don't become colonels. But to have Chris Chibnall of all people messing around with the Brigadier and UNIT, it's expecting like a cheap laugh but a cheap cheer from the fans over that when... I mean, it's bad enough that it's being led by Kate Stewart. Kate Stewart's another one who just delivers empty threats that she never follows through on. I am the head of UNIT. If you don't stop this, when she exposes herself to... when she threatens to expose Prentice, she says, if you don't stop this, I will expose you. And having revealed she knows everything about him, she just goes home alone at night. I mean, she's got to think, what the hell? But if we're going to be talking about things to be nice about, I really liked Azure in this.
Mm.
Her motive didn't make any more sense, but I really liked whoever was the actor for that.
Yeah, her line delivery is excellent.
It's a bit hard, isn't it? We can't find anything nice to say.
I'm happy to give my score, to be honest with you.
Well, here's something I found that was unusual. I don't really take much notice of the rate threads on Gallifrey base, as they always seem to be consistently hugely enthusiastic, regardless of the actual episode in question. The huge proportion of the votes are up in the, 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10. But I went through these 6 episodes, checking what proportion of the voters had given it 1 out of 10, which is described as the worst Doctor Who. And in episode 1 of The Flux, 4% scored it 1 out of 10. In episode 2, 2% did. In episode 3, 7% did. In episode 4, 2% did. In episode 5, 7% of people scored it 1 out of 10. In episode 6, 19% of the voters scored it 1 out of 10, which is almost unheard of on Gallifrey base. And so I think quite a lot of people were left disappointed with it.
Yeah.
What was Dan late for? You know, Diane effectively dumps him because she says you were late.
He never made it to his date, did he? Because Carvanista kidnapped him.
But hadn't you seen him since then when they were walking along in Liverpool talking about pizzas?
No, that was just some messing around in the time stream, wasn't it?
Oh, right. I wonder whether now she's suddenly become so intelligent to become an expert on concepts of time and space. She's moved from someone who finds being face down in a pizza entertaining to be intelligent enough to realise just how wooden Dan's sex talk would be in bed. So she's dumped him.
It doesn't help that he can't open his mouth properly.
I think it's cruel to even mention how wooden John Bishop's delivery of lines is. It's just... What in there? To make the Doctor and Yaz look like they're from the RSC by comparison. But we shouldn't criticise Diane because we've been told she's wonderful. You know, oh, she should teach at the academy. Oh, Yaz is... Oh, she's been brilliant for 3 years. Doesn't have to actually show us her being brilliant for 3 years. Just tell us and that'll be all right. But there we are.
Does anybody know what "you are the universe, Doctor" means?
I don't even say that.
You are the universe, Doctor.
Is it the follow-up to "We Are the World"?
We are the world. But you've ever seen the episode of the Craig Ferguson show where he's got his song about intellect and romance triumphing over brute force and cynicism?
It was the scene that was cut, wasn't it, from his show?
Yeah.
One thing is consistent though, and this is why the show is so beloved by geeks and nerds. It's all about the triumph of intellect and romance over brute force and cynicism. Intellect and romance over brute force and cynicism.
That seems to have disappeared from Doctor Who now. I don't see any romance. I'm not particularly engaged by Belle and Vinda's romance. I don't see the Doctor and Yaz's sudden affection for each other being anything more than an affectation for people who've been having a wet dream about it. And as for intellect, the Doctor hasn't been the smartest person in any room since she crashed through the roof of that train in Sheffield. Who has the idea how to defeat the Flux? Diane. Who, like I said, goes in the blink of an eye. From someone who makes daft jokes about falling asleep in the little pizzas to having a grasp of interdimensional mechanics. And I just think it's all done so bad. And we're left with a TARDIS crew of three for the next three episodes, each of whom has been given a comedy northern accent as a substitute for a personality. And it's, I think with Chris Chibnall, it's just, I was beginning to think it's just naked incompetence. And yes, I've often been incompetent while naked too, but I wasn't always being paid for it. Has anyone got anything to say, or should we go straight to marks out of 10?
Go for it.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being
Marks out of 10? Hayden?
For episode 5. I think I'll give it a 5.
So it's 5 for Survivors of the Flux. And for 6?
For The Vanquishers, for episode 6, I'm going to give it a 2.
Oh, wow.
Mark, episode 5?
I would also give episode 5 5 points. And I will give episode 6... it's difficult, isn't it? I do think it managed to wrap most of the things up properly. I just don't think it did it in a particularly exciting manner for me. I will give it 4.
For me, Survivors of the Flux, I will give 2 out of 10. Episode 6, The Vanquishers, it's been rescued for me slightly by how good I thought the performance of Azure was. And by, I think, a 2 or 3 minute scene when Jodie's being interrogated by Prentice and it's the best she's acted for 3 years. That's rescued it for me slightly, and so I will give episode 6 0 out of 10. Otherwise, I'd have given it a minus. I'm not just being, you know, oh, look at me. I'm just being trying to be dramatic. I think it was... And given that, I think the importance of episode 6, how much people must have been banking on this to, oh, well, this is going to explain everything. I just thought it was a dreadful letdown.
Mm.
So, there we are.
I think it's the nail in the coffin for me for this era. I'm not sure the next 3 episodes can redeem it for me. Because like I've said, there are some highlights which I love, but that probably makes up like a fifth of what we've seen. And yeah, it's not as bad as, you know, Twin Dilemma or Time and Arania and what have you. But for what it promised, well, not what it promised, but what it failed to deliver, but what it could have been.
What it threatened.
Is the reason why I've given it, is the reason why I've given it such a low score.
Series 6 delivered on what it had been threatening for the previous 5 episodes for me. Oh dear. Right, well, faithless listeners.
Oh, are you going to add up the scores that we've given for the 6 episodes?
Oh yeah, I'd like to, because that I was so disappointed with that last episode, really tempted to knock a point at least off all my other scores, because...
Oh my god.
Well, it does detract from the rest of the episodes when the finale just is a bit drab, really. It was that unsatisfying.
Hmm.
So, hang on a sec. So, Halloween Apocalypse, we gave a total of 20 out of 30.
Not bad.
Actually, it's not bad, is it?
No, that's good.
For War of the Sontarans, we gave it 22.5 out of 30. For Once Upon Time, we gave it 20 out of 30. For Village of the Angels, we gave it 26.5 out of 30. For Survivors of the Flux, we gave it 12 out of 30. For The Vanquishers, we gave it 6 out of 30. Oh dear.
Oh no.
So, sorry, faithless listeners, I'm sure if anyone who's been adoring this series will probably have given us a rest after the first 5 minutes of this review. But genuinely, we don't do this to be like, you know, those YouTube channels you hear about. I must admit, I've never gone anywhere near where they're just, well, we certainly don't do it in order to gain, what do they call it when they get money from being on YouTube?
Sponsorship.
To earn any money for it or get any kudos. We want to like Doctor Who, but there we are. But next podcast, faithless listeners, happiness will return and joy will be unconfined. It's our annual Christmas episode.
Yes.
Well, we'll be having things like the Diddly Dum Gold Run, which is all set up and ready. I've deadlocked the Whoseum dedicated Blockbuster studio so that you two can't sneak in and have a look at the questions. Have you two prepared any games for us?
We have a festive Who Said What.
Oh.
And I might have another one in development too.
We'll have Secret Santa. We'll see whether the dearth of heavy goods vehicle drivers in the UK stops us getting our delivery of Coke and the opening of the episode.
I've got my T-shirt ready, haven't I, for that?
But until then, hey, has your voice recovered enough from your cold to do Uncle Terence?
Not quite. I'm still coughing. I'm waking up in the night, I'm afraid.
If only if you have right, the in that personification case, oh. of time. Fresh from its war with space.
So, until next time, listeners. Oh, what's coming down the corridor? Why, it's the Sons of Skaro. Come to say goodbye to us. Dalek Skaros. Have you got anything to say to us at this cold time of year when the waters around the UK will be almost near freezing point?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump bodies into the river.
Oh, do you think they'll just bounce off the ice? Dalek Ray. Christmas is coming. The goose is getting fat.
It's a trap!
Bye-bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye. Till next time.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting, fitted in your ear.